Many small businesses in Illinois are hurting on account of the COVID-19 pandemic. We speak with State Treasurer Mike Frerix.
We saw with the federal PPP program is there was a lot of uncertainty, a lack of information, and then ultimately a lack of money.
We'll hear about a loan program that could offer some relief for business owners. Plus, before his death, Nelson Algren was considered one of the greatest modern American writers. But the author of The Man with the Golden Arm and other works has since fallen into obscurity. We speak with biographer Colin Asher about a great and largely forgotten Illinois writer. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. The news is next. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As we go to air Wednesday morning, state health officials have announced another 2,200 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Illinois, plus another 144 deaths. But as we've said before, because testing for the disease has been so limited, the number of actual cases is thought to be anywhere from 3 to 10 times higher. Later this hour, we talk to the author of a biography on Chicago writer Nelson Algren, once considered among America's greatest living writers, but who slipped into relative obscurity by the time he died in 1981. But first, this week, the Illinois State Treasurer's Office announced it would make another $250 million available to help small businesses. The money goes to banks that can in turn make bridge loans to those businesses aimed at helping them weather the pandemic. I spoke to State Treasurer Mike Frerix about this and other topics in a Zoom conversation yesterday afternoon. Treasurer Frerix, welcome back to the 21st.
It's nice to be back. Thank you, Brian. Thanks for having me.
So there is a federal assistance program for small businesses. How does Illinois' COVID-19 relief program differ?
Well, it is different in that we don't offer loan forgiveness, but our program was never meant to compete with the federal SBA program. We were looking to work in cooperation with them, hoping to design something that could complement what they're doing. But we got something up and running because we heard the stories. We know that people are hurting. We heard them from our friends and family and seeing doors close in our communities. And in the Treasurer's Office, we're not bothered by the partisan gridlock at the federal government, and we're smaller and more nimble. We felt we could get something up and running faster, and we already had relationships with banks in the state. So that's what we did. And that was good because we saw with the federal PPP program is there was a lot of uncertainty, a lack of information, and then ultimately a lack of money.
And could businesses, people qualify for both the federal program and the state program?
That they can. Like I said, we're not in competition. We're going to complement each other. A month ago, we announced the Treasurer's Office was going to set aside $250 million to capitalize banks and credit unions, so that they, in turn, can help small businesses push through this COVID-19 crisis.
And let's maybe help our listeners understand how exactly this works. I mean, the Treasurer's Office has all this money from the state to invest, until it's spent on various things. But X amount of dollars at any one time. And how, what do you do with that money? How does that money get from the, sort of state of Illinois' coffers, so to speak, to potentially helping small businesses?
Under our small business COVID-19 relief program, we deposit funds in a financial institution for a one-year term with participating financial institutions at a near zero deposit rate. You get 0.01%. And generally, we're prepared to offer lending institution deposits of up to $25 million in increments of $1 to $5 million. We're not the only small business loan program out there, but I believe that our program can complement those other programs. I'm the chief banker for the state of Illinois, but we don't have a state bank. So by partnering with financial institutions around the state, my office can make it possible for your local bank or credit union to offer bridge loans that can tide a business over until the details of other state or federal programs can be figured out. At least that is what we hope these bridge loans can accomplish.
So what does a small business have to do to be able to qualify for one of these bridge loans?
We make our qualifications very easy. One of the complaints we've heard with some other programs is they're overly burdensome, were difficult to get information. We have three requirements. One, they have to be headquartered in the state of Illinois or promise to focus on the state of Illinois. We know this is a national pandemic, but as state treasurer, I focus on Illinois. The business has to have been shut down or limited due to COVID-19. And they have to be a small business. They have to have less than $1 million in liquid assets or $8 million in average annual receipts, according to the Small Business Administration.
So you mentioned the state's taking its money, accepting a very low interest rate from the bank, and then the bank in turn loans that money out to the businesses. What do you know what the interest rates are that the bank is charging the businesses?
Well, we offer a low rate in hopes they will then in turn pass those savings along to their customers. Deposit of funds facilitate affordable loans, but we do put a hard limit not to exceed 4.75%. The small businesses and nonprofits can be used to provide bridge funding. They can use it to pay fixed debts, payroll, accounts payable, or other bills they may have.
And I don't know if there's a limitation in the law about how this is done, but is there, I mean, why not distribute the funds directly to small businesses instead of working through banks? Or is that just not even feasible under the way things are currently structured?
Well, in the treasurer's office, that's not feasible. Mm-hmm. I'm the chief banker for the state of Illinois, but we don't run a state bank. We don't make loans directly. So what we've done for more than three decades is we have linked deposit programs. The oldest and probably best known program is AgInvest. So we put a deposit in a bank at a below market interest rate. That bank then makes a comparable size loan to a farmer at a below market rate, but it has to be for a specific purpose. The loans are linked to our deposits. So when we were looking to set something up quickly, rather than creating something new, we already had this authority from the General Assembly to do something similar, and we just tailored it for small businesses struggling during this COVID-19 crisis.
We have heard from small business owners on the show in recent weeks, everyone from people who run bars and restaurants to hairstylists. Many of them, most of them, are struggling. Do you think that the additional $250 million added to this program is enough to sustain them as the stay-at-home order continues?
We think so. We're prepared to revisit this, though. Unlike the PPP, which ran out of money, we never ran out of money. We initially had $250 million available. We've had applications from 27 financial institutions for approximately $220 million that they can use. But not all of that money has gone out yet. But as we saw, we're getting closer to our original limit. We doubled it. We will, if there is continued interest out there, I think we'll revisit that number again. But our program is not as generous as the federal program. The federal program would have forgiven a lot of loans if they were used to keep employees on the payroll. Ours is still very much a loan, and I think that's why you saw PPP run out of money so quickly, but our program has not.
So as you mentioned, these small businesses have to go to a lender, to a bank, to receive the money. Where, and I think you said there were 27 of them, at least in the first round of the program, where are those lenders located? Are they more in the urban areas? Will people in rural areas be able to access this help?
Well, they're located around the state, but the majority of them are in rural areas. And that's because it's rural banks that tend to make more farm loans and are more likely to have participated in our AgInvest program. So we already have relationships with a lot of these rural community banks because of our AgInvest program. Banks in the Chicago area, not as much. So actually we have probably an overrepresentation of downstate banks versus Chicago banks.
So minority-owned businesses have reported that they have missed out on federal funding in the, like we said, the federal program. Business owners in Chicago wrote a letter to President Trump and members of Congress urging 25% of the proposed $250 billion federal payroll protection program go to Black-owned businesses looking for loans in, again, that federal program. How can you ensure that the state bridge loan program is equitable, that it's helping as many, you know, businesses as possible?
Well, because we have not run out of funds right now, They're people who want loans have been able to approach their banks. Now, the banks ultimately make the decision of whom they loan to. They take the risk, but we help supply the capital to them. This means that as a state treasurer, I'm not allowed to have a lot of risk in our investments. General Assembly loves it when we tell them that we increased interest revenue for the state of Illinois, but they really dislike it if we tell them we lost money. Yeah. So this is up to the banks that are participating, but we make this available throughout the state of Illinois. We've had our staff reaching out to financial institutions around the state of Illinois to let them know of this program.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The 21st. We've been talking to Illinois State Treasurer Mike Frericks about a bridge loan program being run out of his office, aiming to help small businesses by taking state money, depositing it in local banks in Illinois, which can then hopefully loan it out to businesses at a relatively low interest rate. Treasurer, Governor, and there's a child yelling in the background in my house here. That happens.
I think that has become the new normal we talk about. We're all working from home these days, at least in the treasurer's office we are, and I assume you're yourself as well. And not only do we have to do our jobs, we've taken on new jobs as educators and tutors to our children.
How's that been for you? I mean, you obviously have a very high responsibility, high power job. Are you having to spend time teaching too?
I do. I enjoy it very much. I have an 11-year-old daughter. She is very self-sufficient. I can set her up in front of her computer with her Wi-Fi. She can work on lessons. But before I entered politics, I worked as a teacher. I enjoy working with young people, see them getting excited about learning. And it's been nice to spend more time with my daughter. All right. I know not every parent has that same experience.
Yeah, no, I mean, those of us who can work from home, I think, are in a fairly privileged position at this point. And I wanted to ask you, turning back to the state financial matters, Governor Pritzker has said that the pandemic could lead to a budget gap of, you know, depending on estimates, one estimate was $6 billion. If the graduated income tax is not approved by voters, it could be even more. I wondered, is there concern about, you know, this? Is there concern about financing this bridge program specifically related to the budget deficit?
No, because this budget deficit is mostly in our general revenue fund. That's the state's largest fund. It funds most of the state's activities you think of. But state government is set up with over 700 different funds. And those funds can only be used for specific purposes. And while that money is waiting to be spent, it's growing. And we're in charge of investing that money. So money in the road fund or the leaky underground storage tank fund or the open space land acquisition fund cannot be used to pay Medicaid bills. It can't be used to pay for our schools. It can't be used to pay for our vendors. So there aren't quite the liquidity needs there. And that's why we're monitoring this. We've made now available $500 million, $500 million, out of a total state portfolio of around $13 to $14 billion. So no, at this point, we're not too worried about liquidity.
My favorite was always the Dry Cleaner Environmental Response Trust Fund myself, in terms of various state funds. And I suppose that it is possible, though, that at least barring the transportation funds, which are now constitutionally protected, some of that other money could be swept. I've heard experts say, well, Illinois doesn't really have, it hasn't filled its rainy day fund, but by being able to sweep these other funds, that is a way that it has been able to bridge state financial problems in the past. But I suppose cross that bridge when we come to it, to badly mix metaphors here. I also wanted to talk about another aspect of your job related to this pandemic. You, along with five other state treasurers, called on manufacturers of ventilators to release service manuals to repair those ventilators. This was back in March. I'm wondering, what is the status of that? Has there been progress? And why did you feel that was important to sign on to that effort?
Well, I am very active in the National Association of State Treasurers. We work with other state treasurers to figure what problems they're dealing with and help offer solutions to each other. And one state treasurer reached out to me and pointed out how, as there was an increased demand for ventilators, some of them were breaking down and that these hospitals would have to call basically a ventilator repairman. Now, there are two problems with that. One, it took them a while to get someone there to repair the ventilators. And two, these hospitals have protocols in place to keep their patients safe. And having people coming in from outside, potentially bringing in viruses with them, was against those protocols. And so these hospitals wanted to be able to have access. They purchased the ventilators. They want to have access to the schematics, to the manuals, so that they could repair them themselves. Now, as an investor in a lot of different companies, we sometimes sign on to such letters, but we thought it would be good and prudent in advance to call on these companies to make sure we had a plan in place so that the ventilators already in our hospitals were able to be serviced in a timely and safe manner.
And what would be your message for Illinoisans who might be small business owners, or maybe they're out of work during this pandemic and they're worried about their finances? Do you have a message for them?
Yeah, this is a difficult time. And when people ask me how I'm doing, and they say it must be difficult having to uproot your office, I remind them that there are a lot of people out there who have it a lot worse than us. And we're going to need to pull together. There's a lot of uncertainty, and we need all hands on deck to help others now to lay the groundwork for recovery later. Right now, I think that if people are unemployed, we have some nice addition. The federal government gave some nice additional money for people on unemployment, but a lot of this depends on how long this goes on. If people are able to go back to work in the next few weeks, the pain and suffering will be a lot less than if this drags on into the fall. That's why it's so important that we all follow the recommendations of our leaders, of our scientists, epidemiologists, and do what we can to knock this virus out as quickly as possible.
Mike Frerichs is the treasurer of the state of Illinois. Treasurer Frerichs, thanks for joining us on the 21st.
Brian, thank you very much. Have a great day and stay safe.
Coming up, Chicago writer Nelson Algren died nearly 40 years ago today in relative obscurity. But one of his biographers, whose book is out this week in paperback, says Algren's focus on inequality and injustice should still speak to us today. I'm Brian Mackey, and this is The 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. My guest for the rest of the show today is Colin Asher. He's the author of a biography of Nelson Algren, Never a Lovely So Real, which is just out in paperback. Algren was once regarded among the greatest American writers of the 20th century, whose subjects were mostly the downtrodden and dispossessed of Chicago. Asher writes, quote, "If you're a fan of American literature, there's a good chance he earned the respect of or inspired your favorite author." In 1940, Richard Wright called Algren the best writer of good prose in the USA. Ernest Hemingway once said Algren was the second greatest living American author after William Faulkner, and later said Algren had topped Faulkner. Unquote. But the FBI spent a quarter century investigating Algren as a communist sympathizer, and in the years following the publication of his masterpiece, The Man with the Golden Arm, in 1949, Algren slipped into relative obscurity. He left Chicago in the 1970s and died in 1981. Asher was born in West Virginia but raised in Brooklyn. He dropped out of high school after ninth grade and spent a decade in California working in warehouses and as a bicycle messenger. He began writing in 2007. He also teaches at the City University of New York. Colin Asher, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Why do you and so many other writers consider Nelson Algren among the best writers of his generation?
Plenty of reasons. For me, first and foremost, Algren is a voice of conscience in American letters. I first encountered him during the depths of the Great Recession, at a time when I was myself not doing particularly well economically and nobody else I knew was, and also at a time when I was feeling more than a bit let down by American letters. I was feeling that writers weren't really grappling with the moral dimensions of the economic crisis we were going through almost exactly 10 years ago now. And I stumbled on Algren's work in that context. I found him to have almost the voice of a prophet. I had the good fortune to find a collection of his work that covered his career from about the late 1930s all the way up towards death in the 80s. And, you know, I found this incredible consistency in his work. You know, for that almost 50 years of his writing career, he was always focused on writing about the portions of society who were often overlooked and neglected by mainstream letters, and overlooked and neglected by the political system as well. And in writing about those people, people who were dealing with addictions, people who were homeless, people who were suffering from, you know, what we would now call economic dislocation, people involved in the criminal justice system, he never sensationalized them. You know, his message always seemed to be that, you know, these people are part of broader society, and as a result, they need to be part of our culture as well, our literary culture. We need to understand their lives and their perspectives on society if we want to understand society itself. He would sort of use, you know, now we would say underprivileged portions of society as a moral barometer for the remainder of society. All that is almost sort of preamble, though, to say that he was also just an incredibly unique writer. There's this incredible lyricism to his prose that I have never quite seen replicated. You know, he wrote poetry throughout his career in addition to nonfiction prose and fiction, and the poetry informs everything he does. There's also just this beautiful sense of rhythm about everything he does. You know, he was a music lover, and he was somebody who spoke about writing both for the eye and for the ear. And he would read his work aloud to himself as he was revising it. And you can, you know, as a reader, I think you get that sense.
Just this morning, I went and pulled my copy of Chicago City on the Make off the shelf and just started reading from the first chapter. He describes Chicago in its early days as a portage, and the portage's single hotel was a barracks. Its streets were pig wallows, and all the long summer night, the Potawatomis mourned beside that river. Down in the barracks, the horse dealers and horse stealers were making a night of it again. Whiskey and vermilion hustlers painting the night vermilion. It's striking, like you say, there's a poetry to it, really, that I think you don't find in a lot of other writers.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's a beautiful section. I'm glad you chose it. You know, it gets to a lot of what I was touching on a moment ago. Yes, you have the lyricism, but you also have, without being polemical, he is also making a moral point there, right? He is presenting this scene where, you know, Chicago is being built upon native land and built by people who at the moment and in the future claim sort of moral high ground. They claim to be more civilized, but as you point out, right, well, they're just horse thieves, is his point of view. I mean, he can deliver a moral message like that without being polemical, without preaching. And you know, it can almost slide by. You know, and I've spoken to many people who love Chicago City on the Make simply for the lyricism. And, you know, you can read it and it flows. And you don't need to even stop to think about the political point that he's making if you don't want to, but it's always there.
In his writing, as you said, Algren focused on, I guess I was going to say downtrodden and dispossessed people, but I mean, there's also, as you said, addicts and grifters and hustlers. And I want to talk about how he came to inhabit that milieu. Can you talk a little bit about the circumstances of Algren's upbringing?
Absolutely. He was born in Detroit, but of course, famously spent most of his life in Chicago. You know, he's a child of the working class. His mother ran a candy store for a brief period of time. His father was a mechanic and a small business owner. You know, he started a tire shop, and that supported the family decently well through Algren's high school years. They never had a lot, but they had enough. Algren had two sisters, and after they moved to Chicago, his mother was a homemaker. So what his father made in this tire shop supported a significant-sized family. However, then the Great Depression strikes. Algren finishes high school in 1927, goes to the University of Illinois, and when he comes back in 1931, it's the depths of the Great Depression, and he finds that, you know, the stability that he had sort of taken for granted in high school is all evaporated. His father's shop has gone bust. He has a sister who was working for Chicago Public Schools. School teachers at the time were being paid in scrip, not in cash, and the scrip had no cash value. So the family really has nothing. Auburn had hoped to be a journalist. And of course, in 1931, there are no jobs in journalism. And, you know, there is nothing for him to fall back on. So he ends up spending a significant chunk of time just drifting about the country looking for work. You know, he leaves home the summer after finishing college, wanders north up to Milwaukee, hopping trains, hitchhiking, sleeping in rescue missions, eating on soup lines, isn't able to find work, returns home for a brief period, and then heads down into the South. You know, all told, he's drifting about for more than a year, completely destitute the entire time, unable to, you know, reach out to his family for assistance because there really is no assistance for them to provide. And at the end of this run, he has come to the conclusion that, you know, the American dream is essentially a myth. And he talks openly about this. He returns home to Chicago in 1933, more or less for good, and talks about how he feels that he had been lied to. He had been told that America was a civilized place where people cared for each other and where if you worked, you could get ahead, and that is false. That insight sticks with him for the remainder of his life. And, you know, many people came through the Great Depression with similar feelings. He felt that he had been abused and taken advantage of, and he was right in thinking that. And that experience forever connects him with everybody else who he feels has been disadvantaged by America and by the American economic system.
If you're just joining us, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, and I'm talking with Colin Asher, whose biography of Nelson Algren, Never a Lovely So Real, is just out in paperback. What are his first steps down the path that would eventually lead him to be regarded as one of America's great novelists? How does he get from the sort of itinerant life and the disillusionment you're describing to the success he would enjoy?
Well, the disillusionment is the beginning of the success. He returns from this ill-fated trip to the South, and he starts writing up a fictionalized, but lightly fictionalized, account of what happened to him. That turns into a story called So Help Me, which was published not long after he returned from the South in Story Magazine, which at the time was a very big deal in the literary world. You know, let's keep in mind, he had no previous writing experience to speak of. He had worked on the college paper and done a creditable job, but was not a particularly standout writer. He sort of toyed around with some short stories in college as well, but none of them really remarkable in any way. But then he has this experience of being on the road, and he writes up a portion of it in a story called So Help Me, which focuses on a gas station robbery, which almost happened, but didn't quite. Well, in the story, it does happen. And it's a really just gorgeous, unique story, written almost entirely in vernacular. Even though this is Algren's first significant published piece, it already has a lot of the hallmarks of his later stuff. There's the lyricism, there's the focus on language, and there's the rhythm that we come to find or come to appreciate in his later work. So that story is published in Story Magazine, as I say, and Algren very shortly afterward got a letter out of nowhere from Vanguard Press, which was, you know, a significant publisher in New York at the time. Having no other publishing experience, having no agent, and having no idea for a novel, Algren just hitchhikes to New York and shows up in the offices of Vanguard Press and presents himself as a man who could write a novel over the course of a few months, which, you know, is not entirely true, but the publisher extends him an advance anyway and gives him a contract to write what will eventually become his first novel, Somebody in Boots, which was released in 1935.
As I understand it, his first books did not sell very well. How does he go from the sort of relative commercial failure to the, I think what many people would regard as the high point of his career, The Man with the Golden Arm?
Well, he was a man with occasionally incredibly good luck and more often incredibly bad luck. His first book comes out in 1935, as I say, Somebody in Boots, and it was a commercial failure, as you point out. Even though, you know, it does have quite a bit of merit and it did receive good reviews. You know, the problem, of course, is it is still the Great Depression. And also, it was a very honest book, as all of his best stuff is. But, you know, it's a book that's being honest about the Great Depression and just how brutal it is to be on the road at that point, which was a hard sell still in 1935. Auburn then has a long period, additional period of unemployment, and then writes a second book, Never Come Morning, which comes out in 1942. And everybody who knows Auburn and who's looked at the book thinks that it's really going to launch his career. Unfortunately, the war, World War II, breaks out right before the book's release. And so it ends up being overshadowed by America's entry into the war. Auburn then serves in the military and comes back to America, you know, after another significant, essentially fallow period. He wasn't writing much at all during the war. However, he comes back to America with, you know, a significant amount of writing experience. He has two books to his name. And publishers at the time were looking to launch people, right? There was money for the first time in quite a while in the American economy circulating. And he gets approached by Doubleday, which was then and is still now a major name in publishing. And it's the first point in his career where somebody decides that they're gonna take a big chance on him. An editor approaches him and offers him essentially a salary for a set period of time if he'll produce a book of short stories and a novel, which is really a godsend for Auburn. Auburn had a very hard time meeting deadlines, and because he had been itinerant for so much of his early adult life, he had a very hard time fighting writing time. But once Doubleday extends him credit and promises to release two of his books, he has what he needs to finally sort of settle down, which he does in Chicago after he returns from the war, and he releases the book of short stories, which comes out in 1947. Called The Neon Wilderness, and then, of course, in 1949, The Man with the Golden Arm.
So what is The Man with the Golden Arm about? Can you tell us about the book itself?
The Man with the Golden Arm is, to my mind at least, Auburn's masterpiece. And it is the story of Frankie Machine, who had been an American GI who's injured during the war. He takes a piece of shrapnel and is treated with painkillers while he's in the service, returns home, unfortunately, addicted to painkillers. And Frankie is a man whose life is sort of defined by his dreams. You know, he grew up poor. He has been poor his entire adult life. He wants many things desperately. He wants to rid himself of his wife, who he's in a very dysfunctional relationship with. He wants to kick his morphine habit. And he wants to become a professional drummer. Of course, none of these things actually happen for him. He never quite breaks free of his relationship with his wife. He never quite breaks free of his addiction, and he never makes it professionally as a drummer. From the beginning book to the end, when he is making money, he's making money dealing cards, which of course is where the book's title comes from. He talks about himself as the man with the golden arm. He's good at dealing. The book is Frankie's story. I could explain the plot, but the plot doesn't really matter, you know, with quite a bit of Auburn stuff. What matters are the characters, and what matters is the atmosphere. You know, Auburn was a novelist, obviously, first and foremost, but he worked the way an investigative journalist works, or maybe, you know, the way many creative nonfiction writers work today. He would find locations, he liked to say, where human lives were in conflict. And then he would just sit back and watch. So when he was composing The Man with the Golden Arm, he befriended a group of people who were themselves in and out of jail, the way Frankie is in the book, who were themselves addicted to morphine, and who were living in on Chicago Skid Row. And he just immersed himself in their lives. You know, he would follow them around as they tried to score drugs. He would sit in their apartment and watch them shoot up and take notes and listen to the way they spoke and just try, he said, to catch the emotional ebb and flow of the room and to try to capture their language. And that's really the book. You know, it's a portrait of America after the war for the folks who did not benefit from the economic recovery that was brought about by the war.
We need to take a break. More to come with Colin Asher on his biography of Nelson Algren, Never a Lovely So Real. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, and my guest today is Colin Asher, whose biography of Nelson Algren, Never a Lovely So Real, has just come out in paperback. Algren, who spent most of his life in Chicago, went from being among America's best-known and regarded writers in 1950 to dying in relative obscurity in 1981. How that happened is the subject of a significant part of Asher's book. Before the break, we were talking about Algren's masterpiece, The Man with the Golden Arm, published in 1949. There's a strong critical reception for this book, as well as success in sales, and it wins, I believe, the first National Book Award. But you write, and we're kind of coming to one of the main conceits of your book, you write that in this book, Algren makes a joke at the expense of two people who'd been ratting out former associates for being alleged communists. And you suggest that in this joke, Algren is sowing the seeds of his own, I don't know if destruction is the right word, but literary downfall, certainly. Can you talk about that?
The reception was, you know, everything a writer could ask for. You know, it's 1949. As I say, sort of America is coming back economically. There's finally a chance for Algren to sell some books, really for the first time in his career. Again, you know, his first two books were 1935 and 1942, and both, you know, both receptions were sort of star-crossed. So 49 is really his chance. The book is backed by Ernest Hemingway. Doubleday gets behind it in a major way. You know, Algren's editor flies from New York to Chicago to do the release. Time magazine celebrates it. It does eventually, as you say, win the first National Book Award for fiction. But context is also necessary for us to understand what ends up happening. You know, this is also the beginnings of the Red Scare. You know, I often reflect on the fact that if, you know, Algren had finished The Man with the Golden Arm maybe a year later, I really doubt that it would have been released at all. You know, it is a deeply political book. You know, as I say, it's the story of America after the war for people who weren't benefiting from the economic recovery. Well, that's not a real welcome story, especially among the political class. You know, many people who had been political activists in the 1930s and 1940s, as Algren had been a member of the Communist Party in the 30s, were finding that they were not able to work in Hollywood or in publishing or really anywhere. You know, this is a period of time where some of Algren's friends from the 30s found that they couldn't even get a job waiting tables. And as you say, there were figures who had formerly been leftists, who had become conservatives, or who had formerly been leftists and were simply interested in taking advantage of their past associations by informing on people that they had known in the past. You know, some of these folks didn't actually become conservative. They just knew that there's money to be made in outing people. And two of these characters, Louis Buddens and Howard Rushmore, Algren does insult in The Man with the Golden Arm. You know, in my book, I sort of hedge about whether or not it was the insult itself that put him on their radar. So Louis Buddens informs the FBI that Algren had been a communist in the 30s. Later, Howard Rushmore does the same. And, you know, the FBI had already had a file on Algren. They first started looking into him in 1940. Their surveillance goes all the way up into the 1960s. Track them for about a quarter century, sometimes paying more attention, sometimes less.
And you write that, quote, Algren blamed himself when his life began falling apart. He presumed the paranoia and depression that began to cripple him in the 1950s were the result of personal weakness and decided his books were not being published because no one wanted to read them. But I think you're suggesting here that there was something else more sinister afoot that was undermining him.
Algren was, he was a Stoic in college. You know, he was a person who sort of believed that you could, you know, master your world if you could master your urges. He carried that with him the rest of his life. And, you know, he brings that mindset to this problem in the 1950s, which is really beyond his control, which is, again, the fact that his career is sort of crumbling. And you know, he is aware that the FBI and that the State Department are looking into him, but he is never really confident that that is what is causing him trouble, and he's never really aware of the extent of the trouble. You know, we should keep in mind, Man with a Golden Arm comes out in 1949, Algren wins the first National Book Award. I mean, he is, at that moment, probably the biggest figure in American letters. Remarkably, from that point forward, for quite a while, he can't sell a book to save his life. Then he has this bestseller, and he has a huge name, and all of a sudden, he can't publish anything to save his life. His next book was Chicago City on the Make, which you quoted from before. Well, that was originally a magazine assignment. You know, it's a very political text. And when he submitted it to the magazine cut out all of the political content. Doubleday, to their enduring credit, decided to publish the book in full, but only after the manuscript was complete. They gave him no advance on it before they saw it. So that, you know, that book came out in 1950. Well, he wanted to write another novel. And you would think, being the first winner of the National Book Award, whose book was both critically and commercially successful, that Doubleday would be very eager to give him an advance for another novel, but they were not. He had an idea, and he had, you know, done some significant work on it, but he could not get a contract to write another novel.
How did you get access to Algren's unredacted FBI file? What was that process like?
It was remarkably easy. For a long time, the FBI had control of Algren's FBI file, but after his death, a certain period of time passed, and the file was transferred to the National Archives. Once with the National Archives, it was re-reviewed, and almost the entire thing was released. He went through significant, you know, mental and emotional disturbance. In the 50s, he was spotted by numerous people sort of, you know, peering around corners before he would go around them, or at one point actually, you know, hiding in bushes when he was supposed to be meeting somebody at a train stop. You know, he would reportedly tell people that he thought he was being watched. And his friends at the time thought that he was losing it. And he thought that he was sort of losing it. Well, you know, the FBI file makes pretty clear that he wasn't actually, you know, the people living in the house across from him were giving information about him to the FBI, and the people living next to him were giving information to the FBI, and the people at the end of the block. And the postmaster in Gary stopped his mail for a month, you know, put a trap on it, and sent a list of everybody who's writing to Algren to the FBI.
It's obvious that Algren never achieves the commercial or literary success again that he did at that sort of high point of his career in the middle of the century. Do you think at the bottom line, it comes down to largely the federal campaign of harassment and intimidation, or is something else at work? Because, I mean, this is someone, as you say, who in your introduction to the book, you say, if you're a fan of American literature, there's a good chance he earned the respect of or inspired your favorite author. This is somebody that a lot of people, a lot of writers look up to. Why is it, in your view, that he never produced again at the level he once had?
It's a great question, and it's one that I wrestled with a lot as I was composing. You know, yes, the government's intervention in his life and his career had a profound effect. One thing that I haven't gotten to yet is at one point he does receive a subpoena from the House Un-American Activities Committee. Now, that subpoena came right as he was finishing A Walk on the Wild Side, and he unfortunately felt that he had to inform his publisher about it because he was asking for their assistance in squashing the subpoena, which seems they were successful in doing. Well, those things converging really have a drastic effect on his career. He receives the subpoena, he tells his publisher, maybe a week or 2 weeks later, he hands them his manuscript. Well, they decide not to publish. Of course, they don't say that they're not publishing because of the House Un-American Activities Committee subpoena, but there isn't really much other explanation. At the time, they say that they're choosing not to publish A Walk on the Wild Side because it's too salacious. But Algren was able to sell it to another publisher within weeks, and they requested very minor changes to make sure that it didn't run afoul of the censors, and then it was published and became a bestseller. there is an effect on his career, unquestionably, and there is an effect on his psyche, unquestionably. But I think the real explanation, I mean, the thing that I keep coming back to is that, you know, unlike most writers, Allgren really was a true believer in the beginning of his career. He was not interested in writing to fulfill some personal ambition, necessarily, although he wanted to be successful. You know, he was a person who believed and who often wrote and spoke about the fact that, you know, literature had sort of a special protected place in society, and that authors had an obligation to use their work to tell uncomfortable truths. And he really thought that writing could change the world. Now, as I said earlier, you know, that was not an unusual idea in the 1930s. You know, many communists at the time thought that culture could shape history. But, you know, he holds on to that idea longer than many other people. And it's really when, you know, when he has to face the fact that he's almost alone in this belief, and that his publishers are not going to back him, and that they're willing to walk away from him rather than, you know, living up to their obligations as devotees to, you know, the power of the written word, he becomes deeply embittered. You know, The Walk on the Wild Side becomes a bestseller. And it's another big moment for Allgren, and it does, not immediately, unfortunately, but it does eventually put quite a bit of money in his pocket. But after that experience of having his publisher walk away from him, of having all this trouble publishing after having written this major book, Man with a Golden Arm, he never really recovers his faith in literature. You know, he keeps writing, but he is openly cynical about not just the publishing world, but about readers and about the power of the written word.
You know, there's so much we haven't been able to talk about, his relationship with Simone de Beauvoir and many other aspects of his life. But before we end, I want to ask about Allgren's relationship to Chicago in particular, because it's, as you said, the city with which he's so closely associated. And I have a clip of him from the early 1960s on the radio talking to his friend Studs Terkel about Allgren's short story, The Devil Comes Down Division Street. This is from the Studs Terkel Radio Archive, courtesy of the Chicago History Museum and WFMT.
I think I wrote it because I've always been told that, and I'm still told that Chicago is a real successful city. That is, it's well known that Chicago is the kind of a place where any young man can be just as lucky as the Gilbert and Sullivan seaman and ever went to sea. You know, he became the ruler of the Queen's Navy by polishing up the handle of the big front door. All you really have to do in Chicago is pick out your corporation and stand in line and be willing to say, I will, and success is bound to come. It's an I will city. Even our proudest poet sells poetry to U.S. Steel in order that we can sell more steel, to make more offices, to accommodate more young men, to keep them saying, I will.
So I appreciate the subtle dig there at, I think, Carl Sandburg, but how did Allgren come to view his home city?
You know, he viewed it as a stand-in for America. You ask what his relationship to Chicago is. Well, it's love-hate, and always was. And that's because that's his relationship to America as well. You know, he saw Chicago really as a synecdoche for what was both right and wrong with the remainder of the country. And he thought that, you know, the people that he was writing about, you know, he was often portrayed as a, you know, almost sort of a provincialist. You know, his characters are very specific, and they're from this very specific place, and they speak in this very specific way. But that's not the way he saw them. And, you know, in some of his correspondence, he said this very clearly to his friends, that he was mystified by the fact that he was so associated just with Chicago, because the way he saw it, Chicago's people were all people. You know, he was writing about America. Chicago was his tool. You know, it was a useful setting for him. It was, you know, it was in his blood. His whole life was there. And it was the only place that he would ever know that well. And that was really, in many ways, the genius of his work. You know, he was a fiction writer, but he didn't make up a whole lot of stuff. He was picking up on the culture in a way that other people weren't, and he was capturing language that other people weren't capturing. But it mostly was a question of capturing it. capturing it, reporting on what was happening around him.
Colin Asher is the author of Never a Lovely So Real on the Life and Work of Nelson Algren. The book is just out in paperback. Colin Asher, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today on the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me on. It was a pleasure.
That's all the time we have for today. Our show is produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Eunice Alpison's our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. I'm Brian Mackey. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.